Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, all good? Excellent. So as Georgia said, we're going to be here for hours. I hope you got your notebooks ready. I must apologise as well in advance because there is a lack of jokes, because there's an awful lot of theology to get through, given it's all about Jesus. And also I should wish you all a happy new year, given this is the first sermon and first church service back. I did question as to when do we stop saying happy new year. There is this just run-up joke in work as to when's the cut-off point. So if anyone knows, that'd be great, let me know. So as George has said, we're starting a new sermon series this evening called Roadmaps of Faith. It's a four-week kind of sermon series covering Jesus, followed by the Bible, then prayer, then we finally end up on church and community. And for me, these are the four core areas and roadmaps to Christianity. And for me, if you really understand these four areas, you kind of really understand Christianity. And also very keen to say, I'm a follower of Jesus. So as I mentioned, tonight we're starting with Jesus. And for me, he is just the bedrock of faith in Christianity. He is the hope that was mentioned in the carol service, is how I would sum this up. And to be quite frank, I really can't do this topic enough justice in the time that I have this evening. I can actually spend hours and hours talking about Jesus. I'm in the process of trying to write a book on it, so hence why I was probably chosen to speak on this tonight. But what I would really, really encourage every single one of you to do is to actually go away and spend time investigating the claims of Jesus. And I've put some resources up here. The first one being The Challenge of Jesus by N.T. Wright, Simply Jesus by N.T. Wright, and there's another one by N.T. Wright as well, which is called The Big Blue One. It's called Jesus and the Victory of God. That one is a very academic book, so I'd highly recommend if you're not too academically minded, I wouldn't really read that. Jump to the Simply Jesus. That one's the easier version. Another book which not many people have heard about is Jesus Through the Middle Eastern Eyes. That's a phenomenally good book. Kenneth Bailey, who wrote it, is a phenomenal author and wrote it very, very well. Then we've also got Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by Richard Bokham. Again, that's quite a very meaty academic book. A very interesting book around the building out of the Gospels and the eyewitness accounts for the build out of the Gospels. So a phenomenal read. And then the bottom three, I should say. First one, a highly good one on the cross of Christ by John Stott. And then the other two, Life and Times of Jesus. That's a double parter. Again, worth a read. And there is just a few books kind of written. And a little bit of a random fact for you is that Jesus is the most written about person in the entire world. If you put all the books ever written about Jesus, you could probably get to the moon and back. That is how many books have been written about Jesus. He's also the most read, researched, and discussed individual in the world. So that kind of begs the question exactly, is who is Jesus and what do we know about him? So I'm going to start off with his birth, and we kind of know that he was born to Mary and Joseph, but he wasn't born in a barn. Sorry to destroy the nativity. So let's just stop for a second and really think this through. So you've got Prince William and the Duchess of Kate. They have to go and register their birth in Cambridge. On their way to registering, their car breaks down outside your house. This is the period of time when everybody's going to register in their own parishes. They have to register where they're from. And they knock on your front door, and in your house already is your family who are registering. And you've also got a couple of other guests that have just stumbled across the way and need a place to stay or a stopover. And they knock on the door and say, hey, have you got room? Your house is full, what are you going to do? Are you going to say yes or no? It's a very high chance, given it's Prince William, you're going to say yes. It's kind of what happened with Jesus. Because, and here's a picture which I'm going to go into in a little bit more detail and explain why, is firstly, if you look at Matthew's gospel, right at the very start on the genealogy, there's a very key moment in that which says that Joseph, who is his father, is an heir or a lineage to King David. So you've got Mary and Joseph on the way to Jerusalem, and you have somebody who is famous, Joseph, because of his great, 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 how many grandfathers back, who's King David. So, what ends up happening, and I guess this is why I'm going to revert to this, is the term inn in Luke's Gospel in 2:17 is that word for the guest room. If you go back a slide, jump this hit. There was no room for them in the inn, which is katamaluna. And that means guest room. So in the old tradition in first century Jerusalem, houses often had, you had the stable section at the right corner, which is where in the daytime or in the evening, they would bring in their animals. So the horses, their cattle, would all come in there. And then just above that, we can see the two little potholes. They are called what's mangers, and they would be stuffed with hay so that when the animals were coming in, they could eat and feast off the hay. And the reason that they were inside in the stable section is because they provided heating to the rooms above. Now, the guest room is where everybody stayed, and you had your living room and family living room, and that's where the whole family did everything on the daytime. So when it says in Luke's Gospel that the inn is full, it's not referring to the inn as a commercial inn, it's referring to the kataluma. The guest room is full. And what ends up happening is they don't stay in the guest room. Mary and Joseph end up staying in the family room. And that is where Jesus was born. And he rested in a manger. So not born in a barn. And we can actually see that in, as I've kind of mentioned, the kataluma. But the commercial word for an inn is a pandocheion. And for an example of that, you have to go to the Good Samaritan story because that is where that word is used. So it's not a commercial inn, it's that inn, which is a guest room. So, now we know that Jesus was born in someone's house. We have his birth, but we actually know very little about his youth. It's really only in Luke's Gospel, in particular in chapter 2, verses 41 to 51, that there's really some kind of mention of him, really kind of in the temple, where his parents have left him behind, great parenting skills. And they've left him behind, and he's really kind of having this really deep theological conversation with the rabbis and the senior leaders in the church. And then that's it. We don't hear anything else until he's around 30, 33 years old, when he starts his ministry work. And in essence, what we can really induce from the Gospels is that he probably did lead and live a fairly normal Jewish life. He would have been educated in the family business. We know that Joseph was a carpenter, so therefore he probably would have high chances he would have been a carpenter. And then he would have gone in there and helped his father. He would have had the same experiences like you or I would in the family home. He would have been a teenager growing up, having those issues, then would have been an adult, and so would have really understood what it means to have had a role in the family life. And I think Dorothy Sayers, who's a British essayist, really sums this up in one of her essays, where she says, "The incarnation means that for whatever reason, God chose to let us fall, to suffer, to be subject to sorrows and death. He has nonetheless had the honesty and courage to take his own medicine. He can exact nothing from man that he has not exacted from himself. He has gone through the whole of human experience, from trivial irritations of family life and cramping restrictions of hard work and lack of money to the worst horrors of pain and humiliation, defeat, despair, and death. He was born in poverty and suffered infinite pain, all for us, and thought it well worth his while." I don't really think I could sum that up any better. So it's only when he starts his ministry do we really start to see who Jesus really is. And this is my statement of him being the Son of God. His statements in John's Gospels of the famous I Am statements alludes to this, and in particular the best one I think is in John chapter 8, verse 58, which he says here, where Jesus says, "Before Abraham was born, I am." Now the I Am statements are normally reserved for God. Today we use them quite interchangeably, but in the first century, I am was a very infrequently used statement. And if we remember in the Old Testament, where it goes back, and in particular in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, where God speaks to Moses, he says, "I am who I am." So when Jesus is saying this to his disciples and saying this to everyone around him, he's expressly stating that he is God. Throughout the whole of the Gospels, Jesus is always alluding to himself as God. He's saying, I am God incarnate, the living God. And for me, one of the best places you can really see this happen on a day-to-day living aspect with Jesus is in the Last Supper. So what happens in the Last Supper is that Jesus is pointing out to the disciples that he is who the prophets, in particular Isaiah, what we see in chapter 53, verse 7, and John the Baptist mention. So what happens at the Passover? So the one I've kind of looked at is more Mark chapter 12. So we have Jesus and the disciples sharing a meal. And this is the Passover meal. So if everyone does remember, and I'm sure you all do, the Passover is the Jewish tradition of them remembering how God saved them from slavery, where, on that fateful evening, God came down and just really, I guess, amongst everyone, his spirit went around and killed the firstborn child unless the blood of a lamb was painted on the door. So, we've got, at the Last Supper, Jesus is breaking the bread, and he's saying, this is my body broken for you. What's Jesus doing? He is creating a covenant, or probably what we would now kind of term as a contract. So nowadays, we would sign a contract with the terms and conditions, and we sign at the bottom. If you don't read the terms and conditions, I highly recommend you do. Because in the first century, that never happened. So what happened when you made contracts in the first century? Often you would get the person who wanted to make the contract or agree with the other party, they would discuss terms, they would go away, they would then come back with normally a cow or a lamb, sometimes multiple, and then they would cut them in half and put them side by side, and then they would walk down as they were reconfirming the contract either side, saying, almost kind of saying, if I break the contract, this on either side is what you can do to me. And I think they should bring that back into contracts these days. I think everyone would keep them. So what Jesus is saying, he's breaking a covenant, saying, I will protect you, I will be with you, this is my body, it's being broken specifically for you. There is that covenant aspect. And then he goes on to the blood, and he says, this is my blood. Again, this dates back again to the Passover, where that evening where they would slaughter the lambs and paint that blood so it would protect them and save them from God's spirit. And that is again what Jesus is doing with his blood. He's reconfirming and saying, hey, this is my blood. It will protect you. But can anyone see anything missing in Mark's description of a Passover meal? So you've got the bread, you've got the wine. Is there anything missing from a general Passover meal? The what? Correct. It's a lamb. So in Passover, they would sacrifice the lamb. And I actually don't think, I mean, scholars kind of debate that there was potentially a lamb, and Mark's omitting it for a reason. But I actually don't think there is, because Mark often is very, quite particular and detail-orientated in his summary. So for me personally, I don't think there was a lamb in Mark's viewpoint of the Passover meal. But what Mark is telling the reader, you and I, is that Jesus is that lamb. He's saying that what Isaiah and John mention is that Jesus is the lamb. The other thing that's really interesting with the Passover meal is historically, once they would cut the lamb and sacrifice it, they would then ingest it. And what ends up happening, if we look about it, when we do the Last Supper, that's now what we do as communion, is we end up ingesting the bread and ingesting the wine. What that means is two aspects. Firstly, we are actually accepting Jesus for who he says he is. We're accepting him as him saying expressly, I am God, I will save you. By agreeing on that contract with Jesus, you are saying, you are my Lord, my Savior. And on a theological aspect, you are ingesting Jesus in you. You know how Christianese always say Jesus is in you? By taking that communion, that is in essence part of what you're doing. So when we actually think about it, that Last Supper and that Passover meal, this is a huge element. that the next time we take communion, we need to be remembering that there is that covenant aspect with Jesus, that we are accepting him as who he is. And then also, secondly, Jesus acts like God. We see him forgive sin. So let's just think this through for a moment by what I mean. Say, for example, I was to come around your house and steal your TV. Jenny hears about it and comes up to me and says, "Richard, you're forgiven." You then come into church and complain and say, "Hey, Richard stole my TV, what's going on?" Jenny says, "Don't matter, I forgave him." How are you going to react? My point here is that the only person that can really forgive is the person that's been wronged. So if Jesus is walking around first century and saying, "Oh, your sins are forgiven," surely he has to be God, because only God can forgive those. So what we have here are two elements. Firstly, Jesus expressly claiming to be God via the I am statement, and then indirectly by his actions. So based on that, it would be my statement that Jesus is God. But I would challenge you all, as I kind of take C.S. Lewis's quote from Mere Christianity, is it's entirely up to you. There's only three options that Jesus gives us. Firstly, he's either a lunatic, he's either corrupt, or he is actually God. But you must decide who he is. And if you do accept Jesus is our God, this does a massive, monumental effect on your life. It changes us because of the love that Jesus has for us. That walk that he made to the cross and dies for us is monumental. And for me, I can't see this any better than in the Garden of Gethsemane. And when Jesus kind of praised to God, "My Father, take this cup from me. If it's not your will, my will." And this is Mark chapter 14, verses 32 to 36, where he says, "They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I pray.' He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to deeply be distressed and troubled. 'My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death.'" I mean, how humane is that of Jesus to say he's so troubled in that last moment that he's calling out, even to Peter, James, and John, and saying, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." I don't really know what Peter, James, and John actually do at that point, but I kind of think it's a little bit weird that someone they know really closely said that, and they don't really do anything. They kind of just go to sleep. Because he then says, "Stay here and keep watch," and we all know that they all fall asleep. And he goes a little bit further, falls to the ground, and just prays this amazing prayer where he says, "Mighty pass from him, Abba, Father." That word Abba is Aramaic for almost daddy. It's the most intimate word you can ever have for father. I actually don't think the English has a more intimate word than basically daddy, but Abba is just really, really intimate. So it's really poignant, I think, that Jesus calls out Abba as his first word. "Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but you will." I think that's amazing. And I'm going to do a little bit of an experiment, hoping it's going to work. Because in the US, a professor in Fort Lauderdale, Florida University, ran this experiment with his class. So I'm hoping it's going to work. So here it goes. So imagine you're walking home tonight, and you see an old lady with a really big purse. It's too big for her to really carry. It's really heavy. You can clearly see there's lots of money in it. And you think about stealing it. So you've got two options. I'm going to give you the two options. Option number one: as you're walking towards her, you begin to think through the consequences of your actions. That you would shame your family and your friends. And potentially you might lose your job. You might lose relationships over it. Even worse, you might actually get caught, have a criminal record, and get ridiculed by everybody. So you don't steal the bag. Option number two: as you walk in towards her, you start to think of the consequences to the old lady. The impact of stealing the wallet would have on her. It would mean that she may not be able to pay her rent, her mortgage. How would she live? Does she have family nearby? If you end up nicking the bag, would it mean that she becomes injured? Is there anybody around to care for her? If she didn't, who would look after her? So, hands up for option number one. One, two. Interesting. Okay, hands up from option number two. Okay. So here's the theological understanding. If you raise your hand to option number one, this is meaning that the culture you're brought up in and you're in is self-centered or more covered on fear and trepidation. It's almost the stick and the carrot attitude. And that your whole thought process is all about you and your status in society and nothing else. Whereas option number two is other focused. You're actually thinking on the old woman. Your focus is more about not you. You're sacrificing your viewpoint and caring about hers. In essence, what we've just discussed in the experiment which I just run is a morality exercise. Now, morality itself comes from, I would say, God and nowhere else. It's up to you to investigate. And what we actually see is the morality impact hitting Jesus here. Because he's torn between, does he go to the cross or does he not go to the cross? If he goes to the cross, it's going to cost him everything, yet cost us nothing. If he doesn't go to the cross, it doesn't cost him anything, but costs us everything. And we can just see it there. He's saying, please don't let it be my will. Please don't let it be my will. It has to be yours. But only if this is your will. It's not my will, because my will certainly isn't going to the cross. Jesus is putting his thoughts, his desires, everything else again, leaving that all because of the love he has for us. He's sacrificing his desires for our desires. And this gentleman up here who is Søren Kierkegaard, who's a Danish philosopher, I think sums it up very well, which is what the age needs is not a genius, but a martyr, who in order to teach men to obey what would himself be obedient unto death. And so I think there are just so many books written about Jesus because he was unique. There was something special about him that meant people followed him, listened to him, and also even after his death and resurrection, they still followed him to their deaths. I don't think there is any other religion that can match what Jesus does for us. So if we were all to go for a swim in the sea and suddenly we all got into trouble and on the cliff or on the beachside was every single leader of every other religion, only one of those would actually come in and potentially die saving us. And that person would be Jesus. So I want to come to a close with a bit of a story, and this is about Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf. So next slide. That's him on the left. Clearly not the painting. Now, he was the billionaire of his time. He was the richest of rich. He was almost the Rupert Murdoch, the Carlos Slim of the world. He came from a very, very wealthy family. He was in line to earn all of their graces when his parents died. He was a man who had everything, could buy everything, could do everything he wanted. And whilst he was about 21, he kind of travelled Europe to kind of study, learn about the world. He came across this painting, which is Domenico Fetti's Ecce Homo. It became famous quite a few years ago because it was the one that got badly redrawn, if anyone remembers it. It looked like an ape. And not look like Jesus. But he saw this, and his life changed. After seeing this picture, he spent his whole life investing in people and supporting charitable causes. He helped plant churches, he helped set up universities, and he also set up hospitals. His family was one of the richest in the world. They had been for a few generations. Yet by the time he died, he was penniless. Yet he died extremely happy. The reason I think is because at the bottom of that painting says these words, "All this I did for thee, what dost thou for me?" I think when Count Nicholas read those words, it changed him inside because he spent the rest of his life pursuing Jesus' cause and not his cause. He gave up everything for one thing, Jesus. That one free gift that cost him nothing is what he pursued. So as I end, I want to ask you guys and all of us the same question. All this I did for you, what will you do for me? This evening, tomorrow, this week, this month, and this year, what will you do for Jesus that he hasn't already done for you? So I'm going to end by reading Francis Assisi's prayer. And then the band can come back up. Lord, make me an instrument of your grace and peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is inquiry, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O divine master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, not so much to be understood as to understand, not so much to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, it is in dying that we awake to eternal life. Amen. So as I was preparing the sermon, there was a number of areas that kind of hit me as to what God was talking to me about. And I guess firstly I want to say and just ask for, if anyone wants to really follow Jesus this year, to come forward and seek prayer. If you want to know that really big experience that Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf experienced that transformed his life, to come forward. If you're here for the first time and have big burning questions and you don't really understand, or you're just exploring at the start of your journey of faith, to also come forward. It's not anything to worry, to be prayed for. It's a good thing. Nothing bad will happen, trust me. And also, this is probably going to be a bit of a step out, but I do believe, and we as a church believe, that Jesus heals. We know in the Gospels he heals so many people. And if you do have any injury, illnesses, or anything you would like pray for, to also come forward. And then my final call is, if you just really want to know, again, I'm going to go back to the first one, it's just if you really want to know that grace, that amazing thing of Jesus, and the love that he's done on the cross, to again come forward, it's a big ask, but hey-ho.